Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Even if you're not a classical music expert, you've probably heard of Chopin. But you'd have to be a serious fan to know the name of John Field, who invented the nocturne before Chopin got his hands on it. Many people know Duke Ellington's Take the A-Train, but only a real jazz buff knows the singer Betty Roche, who recorded the classic version of that song and then released what I think was an overlooked masterpiece in the late 50s.
Lord knows the sun's gonna shine. He can't come home just as late as can be. Yes, a home without him ain't no home to me. Can't help loving that man of mine.
Music history is full of forgotten composers, singers, instrumentalists, some of whom were hugely successful and celebrated in their lifetimes. So I'm not going to make any predictions about today's musical guest, the Canadian singer Lila Bialy. Maybe she'll be famous, maybe she'll be forgotten, maybe first one, then the other. But I will say that I've enjoyed getting to know her jazzy take on the songs of Joni Mitchell or Leonard Cohen. Her band will play for us shortly. But let's start with a shining example of just how fickle musical fame can be.
She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she called a doctor, woke him up and said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor, to relieve his belly.
In the early 1970s, Harry Nilsson was one of the most famous musicians on the planet. But when he died in 1994 at the age of 52, most people had completely forgotten him, even though they still remembered some of his songs, like this little novelty number called Coconut. The British writer and radio host Alan Shipton has now chronicled his enigmatic story in a new book called Nilsson, The Life of a Singer-Songwriter. Alan Shipton joins us from the studios at BBC Oxford. Alan, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Very nice to be here again.
Last time you were on Soundcheck, you had written a book about Cab Calloway, and it seems like, you know, you've done a lot of writing about jazz. What intrigued you about Harry Nilsson?
I think Nilsson was a bit of a surprise, really. He sort of came up on the inside without me noticing. I was in the States writing a book about Jimmy McHugh, the songwriter, and I guess that's a clue to what intrigued me about Nilsson. Jimmy McHugh wrote for ragtime, he wrote for the jazz era, he was friends with opera singers, and he went right through to the rock and roll era. So it's sort of one-man history of 20th century popular music. And his grandson introduced me to Richard Perry, the record producer. And we had lunch, and I started talking to Richard about his work, and that's a pretty impressive career. But the one figure that came out of that was Harry Nilsson, and Richard had produced two great albums with Harry Nilsson, Schmilsson and Son of Schmilsson, both of which I knew very well. And I said to him, Richard, has anybody ever written a book about Harry? Because I'd love to know more. And he said, nope, there never has been one. And that's really what piqued my interest. And from then, I scurried away and discovered that Harry had half written an autobiography and then died. That had never been resurrected, never been published. And there was a mound of papers that the family, distraught with his death, had just put away and never looked at.
So you had all of this primary source material just begging to be used.
For a biographer, that's an absolute dream. And strangely enough, it was very much the same thing with McHugh, a man who never threw anything away. Mm. There's a warehouse full of everything from bus tickets to taxi receipts to contracts. They were quite extraordinary.
Well, now, with Harry Nilsson, there's a kind of an irony here. He's a singer and a songwriter, but as a singer, his big hits were songs he didn't write, and his big hits as a songwriter were big hits for others. You know, for example, Three Dog Night covering his song One. How did that kind of dichotomy happen?
I think there were two reasons for it. The first thing was that Harry was adamantly opposed to appearing in public. Now, if you're going to be a pop singer, normally you want to do it because you want to get up there on a stage in front of a crowd, but he didn't. And almost everything he did in his professional career until John Lennon was killed, and that slightly changed things because he began to appear on stage to raise money for gun control. Mm-hmm. But until that moment, Harry had managed to live the life of a full-on rock and roller without ever appearing live on stage throughout the main part of his career. And that's an extraordinary achievement. But of course, what it meant was he didn't sing his own songs to a public. And the bands that did, Three Dog Night was doing a stadium tour at the time that Harry was simply resolutely refusing to appear. So of course, everybody reckoned that the song was theirs.
Right. I know I was surprised to find that it was, in fact, a Harry Nilsson tune. Equally surprising to many would be that Harry Nilsson's Grammy-winning hit song Everybody's Talkin' from the film Midnight Cowboy was in fact not his song. I mean, so closely associated with him.
Yes, written by Fred Neil. And actually, if you go and hear Fred Neil's version of it, which is from an album which he did just around that time on the Capitol label, it's not very good. I mean, it's quite extraordinary that Nilsson and his producer, Rick Jarrett, heard it and they thought, we can do something with this. And the two biggest hits that Nilsson had were both cases of taking a song that somebody else had done all right with, but not really made work properly. And with a little touch of genius, Harry's extraordinary voice and an absolutely brilliant arrangement by a man called George Tipton, this song, Everybody's Talking, was transformed from an everyday kind of Greenwich Village sing-alongy folk song into a masterpiece.
Everybody's talking at me. I don't hear words they're saying. Only the echoes of my mind. People stopping, staring. I can't see their faces, only the shadows of their eyes. I'm going where the sun keeps shining through the pouring rain. Going where the weather suits my clothes. Banking off of the northeast wind. Sailing on summer breeze and skipping over the ocean.
Harry Nilsson with Everybody's Talkin', originally from his 1968 album Aerial Ballet, but of course it was included in the film Midnight Cowboy and became a smash hit in 1969, won a Grammy for Nilsson, the first of two in his career. The book is called Nilsson, The Life of a Singer-Songwriter by Alan Shipton. He's with us from the studios at BBC Oxford. So sketch for us briefly who this guy was. I mean, he was born to humble beginnings in a rough neighborhood in Brooklyn before moving out west. How did he become just Nilsson, which was the only name he used for a while there in his heyday?
That was a sort of marketing a ploy which came in the mid-1960s. As you say, had this very rough childhood, grew up in the 40s in Brooklyn, just at the tail end of World War II. And then his mother, who separated from his dad, who was a bit of an alcoholic and a bit of a spendthrift, she used to bounce checks, and there were always bailiffs and lawyers coming after him. The children had a ghastly time avoiding being taken into care. She kept skipping off somewhere else. So they went to the West Coast. Then she ran up just too many debts and drank just too much and had too many lovers there. And she had to come back to the East. And so Harry's childhood was this sort of skipping between coasts. And eventually, as a teenager, his mother vermoothed from Long Island, went back to California. And Harry, at the age of 15, hitchhiked from coast to coast in the States. And that was a big growing up experience for him. And I think the things that shaped his lyrics as a songwriter was that very, very tough childhood, the loss of his father, who he thought was dead, but actually he'd simply gone off and married somebody else. And when Harry became famous, his dad suddenly reappeared, and that was quite a shock for him. But that shaped the man who he was as a lyricist, a very tough childhood, very ironic sense of humour. He could turn the most tragic consequence into something funny and throwaway. So when aged seven, his beloved pet cat was frozen stiff in a blizzard, and when the snow melted, they found this thing scratching at the door trying to come back into the house. Harry said, oh,
frozen, gosh, frozen in that position.
Frozen stiff. He said, oh, he looks like the Roadrunner. I mean, it was throwing off something that really meant a lot to him with a joke, and he would do this right the way through his life.
Is that where Schmilson, Nilsson Schmilson, comes from, that same sense of humour?
That's that, and of course Richard Perry, also a Brooklyn boy, and very much a Jewish Brooklyn boy, with all the shtick and the humour that comes from that. That's a title they cooked up together, and from then on, Nilsson always, as I was going to say, shined his letters, Schmilson, but that's what he did. He always used to sign himself Big Daddy Schmilson or Schmilson, or just Schmiel.
We're talking about Harry Nilsson, the singer-songwriter. 1967, he releases the album Pandemonium Shadow Show. You write about, you know, it was originally supposed to be titled Something Wicked This Way Comes after the Ray Bradbury novel. But for various reasons, it becomes this other title instead. And on it is a song called 1941, which seems to go, Alan, to exactly what you were just talking about, this odd mix of irony and humor with this really kind of pathos-laden, deeply emotional story.
Well, the lyric begins, well, in 1941, a happy father had a son, and by 1944, the father walked right out the door. In 45, the mum and son were still alive, but who can tell in 46 if the two are to survive? And I think that ran right through his life. I mean, even though he was reconciled with his father, history repeated itself, because in the early 70s, Harry did exactly the same thing to his own son, Zach. It was chillingly, it's like another thing like the mirror. Mm. There are lots of things, lot of portents in his life that then come round and become true later on.
The song is called 1941, early song from Harry Nilsson.
Well, in 1941, a happy father had a son. And by 1944, the father walks right out the door. And in 45, the mom and son were still alive. But who could tell in 46 if the two were to survive? Well, the years were passing quickly, but not fast enough for him. So he closed his eyes till 55, then he opened them up again. And when he looked around, he saw a clown, and the clown seemed very gay. And he said, I'd like to join that circus clown and run away. Yo do do ho ra di di la da dum da da da. Yo do do do.
Just a little bit of 1941 from the early Harry Nilsson record, Pandemonium Shadow Show. Nilsson, The Life of a Singer-Songwriter, is a new book from my guest Alan Shipton, the English author, music critic, and BBC host. And Alan, in the book, you write about the Nilsson sound, this kind of close harmony in the brass especially, which we just heard there in 1941, and that is pretty much the work of a guy named George Tipton. They have a falling out later in Nilsson's career, and Tipton was not in that documentary that they did about Nilsson a couple of years back, and I don't see him, you know, in your list of interviews either. Does he just refuse to talk about his work with Nilsson?
He has spoken to one or two close friends of Nilsson about it, but he absolutely didn't want to be in the documentary. I worked quite closely with John Scheinfeld, who produced that film, Who is Harry Nilsson and Why is Everybody Talking About Him? And I made efforts to try and contact him. It's interesting, almost everybody who knew Harry really, really wanted to talk to me for this book. So people like Van Dyke Parks, Perry Botkin Jr., Eric Idle, a lot of the people who worked with him over the years wanted to tell the Harry story because they loved him dearly. Jimmy Webb is another one. And yet, for some reason, George Tipton, who, as you say, shaped what was called the Nilsson sound, that mournful brass, along with a slight sense of circus, and there's a big circus tradition. Nilsson's grandfather actually ran a circus in California. The Scandinavian branch of the family arrived in the United States, and Harry's grandfather ran something called the Aerial Ballet. And I always thought this was a bit of a myth until I found some court cases from the 1890s which actually proved that Mr. Nilsson was indeed running a sort of ballet mixture of circus and trapeze show, and somebody else had infringed his copyright and he went to court to protect it. So it really is a circus tradition, and Rick Jarrod, the producer, and George Tipton, with both of whom Harry fell out, were the people who created that sound that somehow captured the circusy, nonchalant surface side of the songs with that deep meaning that we saw in 1941. hidden underneath.
The sound of all that brass is also somewhat reminiscent of the Beatles, who were very much, you know, exploring some of those same sounds. And there's the famous press conference story where John Lennon is asked who's his favorite American group and answers, Nilsson. And then later, Paul McCartney is asked the same question, and he too says, Nilsson. They all become kind of not just fans, but eventually friends of Harry Nilsson, aren't they?
Friends and collaborators, and the two great friendships in Nilsson's life were John Lennon and Ringo Starr, and in different ways they both led to a very fruitful partnership. I think with Lennon the partnership was slightly compromised by the fact that both of them rather enjoyed what is known as the nightlife.
what we euphemistically call the rock and roll lifestyle.
Absolutely, and the album Pussycats, which Lennon produced for Harry, is not his finest work, I have to say, and not either of their finest work, although it does have some good moments on it. Interestingly, I think Ringo and Harry produced some great pieces of music, and my favourite of all of them is Ringo's You're 16, You're Beautiful in Your Mind, old song put back together by Ringo, and all the other voices on that hit single, which went to the top of the charts both sides of the Atlantic, are Harry. He is the falsetto voices, he's the bass voices, he's all the oohs and ahs.
You're my baby.
That's what the Beatles meant by Harry's our favourite group. He had that ability to be a complete choir in himself, and perhaps there's no better example of that than the album he made with Randy Newman, where there are apparently on one track over 101 overdubs.
Mm. Important to mention that when he recorded that Randy Newman record, nobody knew who Randy Newman was. It was a big boost to his career when Nilsson took him on.
And equally, nobody knew how to overdub in more than 8 tracks. So suddenly to have a 100-track overdub, that is really pushing the technology beyond its limits at the time. So you've got two things. Harry spotting another person who's writing with this slightly off-centre and original, interesting kind of song, exactly the thing that Harry himself liked to do. And at the same time, pushing the technology so that what they create is unlike any album that's ever been made before.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about Harry Nilsson with his biographer, Alan Shipton. First biography of the singer-songwriter who was such a huge figure in the 1970s, especially the early 70s. And Alan, you mentioned the friendships with John Lennon and Ringo Starr, especially with The Point. There's this animated ABC TV movie, and this is another collaboration with Ringo Starr, right?
Well, Ringo voiced the eventual DVD issue of it, but in fact, the original voice on the first television film was Dustin Hoffman, whom Harry just persuaded to put the voiceover for, well, Dustin Hoffman was earning over $1 million a movie. He did it for 20 grand, which seems to me like nothing, and that's what Harry described it as. He did it for nothing, he said. So, yes, The Point, really interesting idea. This is, Harry had... There's a great undercurrent in Harry's life. There he has this alcoholic mother. He fights off alcoholism himself. During the early years when he's really building his career, he's a responsible bank clerk. He spent 8 years working in a bank in the greater Los Angeles area, and he worked in the night shift, so he would then go on and spend the rest of the night writing songs, fall asleep in the small hours of the morning, and spend the daytime hours going around music publishers selling what he'd written during the night. Didn't need a lot of sleep, evidently, as a young man. Now, in that period, when he's really trying to make it, he doesn't drink and he doesn't smoke very much. But then everybody's talking, starts to sell, it's his first million seller, he wins a Grammy, and he starts relaxing a bit. And two things. Harry loved taking drugs and he loved drinking. So he started doing both, making up for lost time. And The Point comes from an LSD trip. He used to live on Woodrow Wilson Drive in the Hollywood Hills. He was taking his dog out for a walk and looking at one of the hiking trails, absolutely out of his head on LSD. And all the trees suddenly looked spikier and sharper than he'd ever seen them. All, every blade of grass looked spikier and stronger. And suddenly he realised, as he says, everything had a point. And that was the beginning of the inspiration of this morality tale that became one of the most successful children's television films of all time.
So his own Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds story.
Completely, yes. Very different from the sort of in-your-face psychedelia of the Beatles. It's much more subtle with Nilsson. But actually, if you look at the film, it's a trip.
Let's hear Me and My Arrow from The Point from 1971, this animated TV movie for ABC.
Straighter than narrow, wherever we go, everyone knows it's me and my arrow. Me and my arrow. In the high road, wherever we go, everyone knows it's me and my arrow. And in the morning when I wake up, she may be gone, I don't know.
Me and My Arrow from Harry Nilsson and his animated ABC TV movie The Point from 1971, originally narrated, as Alan Shipton was telling us, by Dustin Hoffman. The DVD is narrated by his longtime friend Ringo Starr. You mentioned, Alan, that Harry Nilsson enjoyed drugs and alcohol and, you know, sort of walked out on his first wife and son, remarried, had another family. The decline of his career is paralleled by a precipitous decline in his finances. He was the victim of some major embezzlement, right?
Yes, though, I mean, I think he's also the victim of not keeping his eye on the ball with the company that he'd founded to make films. His later life, you have to imagine that all the way through the 70s, although he was less popular than he had been, he continued to make albums. Mm-hmm. So almost two albums a year for RCA right through the period that he wasn't particularly popular. And some of them have some real artistic treasures buried in them. Then the 80s begins. Lennon's killed and he throws everything into gun control. The contract with RCA is over. He's not making an album a year for them. He makes one album for Mercury, which strangely enough has never been issued in the United States till now. It's only just come out. Flash Harry was originally on Mercury in the UK and Japan. Never came out in the States. Got some great music on it, including this collaboration with Eric Idle. It's the only Nilsson album which one of the songs is not by Nilsson. It's not sung by Nilsson. It's Eric Idle singing a song about Harry, which is rather sweet. The Monty Python Eric Idle singing about Harry making songs. So he doesn't make any more albums. In the 80s, he does a little bit of music for films. He writes a stage musical with Perry Botkin. He does the music for Popeye, the movie. But the career loses its momentum. And then he decides, with Terry Southern, the writer who wrote Magic Christian and various other things, to start a film company. And they make one movie which pays them quite a substantial amount of money, and that's The Telephone, which starred Whoopi Goldberg. Unfortunately, they never followed it up with any other movies, but they carried on spending as if they were making a movie a year. And the business manager that they had running that company simply didn't tell Harry what was going on. So once she'd eaten up the company's money, she started using his money as a pop star. And he ended up one morning with a foreclosure notice coming through the doorstep of his house. And he, as he said, he went to bed that night thinking he got $2 million in the bank. And he woke up in the morning and had 40 bucks.
And would have suffered his a kind of massive heart attack, about a year or two before the one that eventually killed him at the age of 52. That was in 1994 when he died. Alan, where do you hear his influence, echoes of Harry Nilsson's work in what's around us today?
Well, I think it's influenced a lot of people in quite subliminal ways. So you do find a number of artists. There was a very interesting album made just after his death called For the Love of Harry, in which people right across the spectrum, friends like Jimmy Webb and Randy Newman got together, but also members of various other bands got together. And you realise that from the way that his songs were picked up by groups as different as Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass and Lulu and even Astro Gilberto did a version of Without Her, he was writing songs that were picked up right across the spectrum of popular music from the 70s, and they've never really gone away. I think also the fact that The Point had a subsequent career as a stage show, both sides of the Atlantic. It ran in London with The Monkees, Mickey DeLenz and Davy Jones, both starring in it on the West End stage here in London. And then it was revived again in the 90s in Los Angeles. That's had a big influence too, because almost every children's cartoon musical you see ever owes something to The Point, which was the first specific children's cartoon to be made for telly. And I think the other thing is that the soundtrack to Midnight Cowboy, that evocative sound that we heard with Everybody's Talking, a song which wasn't going to be the title of the film. They tried to commission other people, from Paul Simon, and Bob Dylan even wrote a piece for it. Harry wrote a piece himself, which wasn't used in the film. But that evocative sound somehow summed up a period. And when John Barry wrote the score for the rest of the film, he based it on that George Tipton arrangement for Harry, because you couldn't really come up with any other musical formula for the rest of that film. And so in the same way that that film summarises an era, Dustin Hoffman, of course, starring in that too, with John Voight, Harry's music is the soundtrack to a whole period of the end of the flower power generation, the end of the 60s, and on through psychedelia and into the 70s and early 80s. And I think that's the enduring legacy. There's almost no movement that follows that hasn't at some point borrowed a little bit from Harry.
Even indie rocker Amy Mann has recorded a version of Harry Nilsson's song One, which Three Dog Night had that hit single with so many years ago. The book is called Nilsson, The Life of a Singer-Songwriter, a fascinating life and career. Alan Shipton is the author. He's been with us from the studios of the BBC at Oxford. And Alan, nice to have you with us back on Soundcheck today. Thanks so much.
John, it's been a pleasure.
One is the loneliest number that you'll ever do. Two can be as bad as one. It's the loneliest number since the number one. No is the saddest experience you'll ever know.
We need your help creating a playlist for this Friday's show, but you'll need to think about it a bit. We'll explain why in just a moment. Later, a live performance in our studio from jazz vocalist Lila Bialy. This is Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Last week on the show, during our look at music from the summer of 93, we introduced a feature on our website, soundcheck.org, called Missed It Then, Love It Now. Our staff wrote about albums that they missed the first time around in 1993, but which they eventually discovered and came to love. Now it's your turn, and our producer Joel Meyer is here to tell us how and why and the wherefores. Joel, hi.
Hey, John. Well, last week we had such fun with the Missed It Then, Love It Now concept in the context of 1993. Mm-hmm. That, well, we had a feeling that listeners probably have some of these picks of their own. So now we're going to open it up this week to you listeners, and we want to know, what song or what album did you miss out on when it was released? Because either you just weren't paying attention, or perhaps because you weren't born. But then you've somehow discovered later and now really, really love. So that's the challenge that we're asking you, the Soundcheck listener.
So it doesn't have to be 1993.
No, in fact, we're opening up to maybe it shouldn't be 93,
because really,
we spent a lot of time on 93 last week. Let's hear some picks from different years.
All right. So give me an example. What's a song that you missed first time around and love now?
This is something that I just discovered, even though it's a really old song, just a few weeks ago. Maybe about a month and a half ago, we had the Brooklyn artist Eleanor Friedberger on the show. And there's a really, really great moment in the interview where she very, very passionately talks about a song by the Dwight Twilley Band.
I only discovered this guy Dwight Twilley last year.
Oh, yeah.
Do you know?
You look
very skeptical. But he's got this song.
He's got
this song.
Wasn't my thing, but you know.
Listen to this song called Looking for the Magic.
All my life I've been looking for the magic.
Says on a
right. Dwight Twilley Band, 1977 song called Looking for the Magic. Eleanor Friedberger was touting us on this song.
That's right.
When she
and
was
then,
here.
Like almost a week later, Greta Gerwig, the actress, was here in the studio and talked about it as well, too. So they're attending the same parties or something. But just listening to that song, John, that's the band Spoon. In the 2000s, it's just that it was recorded in 1977.
Yeah.
Clearly, the band Spoon was listening to Dwight Twilley when they did records like Ga 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 Ga.
Well, I got to say, I kind of missed that first time around, too, although you had a different excuse from me.
I was a year old.
I was not. Should have known better. Missed it then. Nice song. All right, so here's what we're doing. Give us your pick for Missed It Then, Love It Now, and we'll crowdsource some of these for Friday's show.
That's right. That's right. And so, again, it can be from any year, not from 1993. It's a song that you or an album that you missed out on the first time around and that you love now. And what we really want to hear are good stories. How did you discover it? And or maybe why did you miss it? So those are going to be some of the things that we're looking for. We want you to leave us a voicemail at 866-939-1612. Or you can post your pick and your comment on soundcheck.org. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook.
And again, that number, 866-939-1612. All right, Joel, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
The Canadian jazz vocalist Lila Bialy has set up shop at the venue Subculture in Greenwich Village, and she'll take a break from her month-long residency there to perform here in our Soundcheck studio. That's next.
The tree of life, I just picked me a plum. You came along and everything started to hum. Still, it's a
this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. In the background, a live recording of the song The Best Is Yet to Come from jazz vocalist and pianist Lila Bialy. The Canadian-born, Brooklyn-based artist has toured around with people like Sting, Suzanne Vega, and Paula Cole. And in 2011, she earned a Juno Award nomination, which is the Canadian equivalent of the Grammys, for her album Tracing Light. I'll talk with Lila Bialy in just a bit about what she's been up to lately, but first, she is here with her trio to perform a song you might be familiar with a version of Woodstock. This is Lila Bialy and her trio live on Soundcheck.
Life is for learning. ago.
That is the vocalist and pianist Lila Bialy live on Soundcheck with her version of the song Woodstock, with Ben Whitman on drums and Chris Tarry on electric bass here in the Soundcheck studio. Lila, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Now, many people will be familiar with that song through the hit version from Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. Your version, a very clear sonic reminder that after all is said and done, it was a Joni Mitchell song.
That's right.
Is she? I mean, there's more than a tinge of Joni Mitchell in your singing there.
Well, it's hard to avoid when you've listened to Joni for as long as I have. I fell in love with her when I had gone off to college, and a boyfriend at the time introduced me to her music, which, you know, was one of the few singer-songwriters that jazz musicians who I was going to school with were listening to. Her mm-hmm. music was sort of legit amongst the jazzers.
You know, I'm a little surprised that growing up in Canada that you could get all the way to college without having you know, been exposed to Joni Mitchell's music.
Yeah.
I mean, there's the Great American Songbook, which
yes.
you know, and you've tackled parts of that. Is there a Great Canadian Songbook? The Leonard Cohens, the Joni Mitchells, the Neil Youngs?
Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, I was invited by the CBC in Canada to create a CD, an album for them, where I was to take songs from the Great Canadian Songbook, as it were, of
now,
my
do,
own
do
choosing.
Do people use that term?
They totally do. So, for example, but I feel like I coined it, John, because this was back in 2007. And then, you know, more recently, I toured with the Canadian saxophonist Phil Dwyer, and he coined his project, or called his project, the Great Canadian Songbook.
Mm-hmm.
And then more recently, I did a Canada's birthday bash at Joe's Pub, and they also referenced the Great Canadian Songbook. So it does exist, but it's kind of what you want to make of it, I suppose.
Yeah. At Canada's birth, that's July 1st, right?
You got it.
Okay. Just a few days before our own
American birthday party on July 4th. Now, you're living here in the States these days, in Brooklyn.
That's right.
Do you still consider yourself, are you still flying the flag for Canada?
Well, I will always be a Canadian at heart, but I love the U.S. of A. And my husband is American.
Mm-hmm.
And
our son, Ben over here behind
the
drums.
Ben Whitman on the drums. We met in Paul the Cole's band and got married a few years later.
you rock and rollers, even though you're jazzers.
It was rock and roll with Paula, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But anyway, our son is, belongs to both countries, and I'm on my way. And I really love it here. So I sort of consider myself bi, as it were. Bi civic.
By country.
By country.
Whatever. Now, growing up in as a, someone who came to jazz in your teens, I guess, New York seems to be, the place where you want to go. How much of a jazz scene is there in, say, Toronto?
Oh, wow. There is an absolutely flourishing jazz scene in Toronto. Toronto, I would say, is kind of like the New York of Canada.
Uh-huh.
In my humble opinion, and with all due respect for the other cities, because I think there's really fantastic creative music happening across, from coast to coast in Canada, I do think Toronto is kind of the place to be for jazz.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the finest musicians in the world have come out of Toronto and still live there. Don Thompson, the legendary pianist and composer who I actually studied with when I was at Humber, and scores of other fantastic musicians. Chris Terry is also a Canadian here on the bass.
All right. Lila Bialy is my guest here in the Soundcheck studio. Her latest album is called Live in Concert, and she is in residence at Subculture New York, which is on Bleecker Street, every Monday through the month of July. A lot of the live album, there are a couple of covers, songs people will know. Then there are a number of originals. Do you write them with Ben, or these kind of collaborative things?
They are. Ben and I are actually working on a new sort of pop project together that's really fun. But the songs from Live in Concert span sort of a range of my writing and of years, as it were. So Still the One was a co-write. I actually conceived the music on my own, melody, harmony, and set a poem to the melody, which I was doing in live performance, and it was great. But somebody finally walked up to me and said, it was from the public domain. That's a really old Canadian poem. And a friend said, you might want to contemporize the lyric. So I called up Mark Jordan, who's quite a well-known songwriter. His songs have been covered by Rod Stewart, and he's been in New York, L.A., and now resides in Toronto. Anyway, he took this melody and added his own lyrics. So this Still the One is a co-write with Mark Jordan.
All right, let's hear it. It's Lila Bialy at our piano. Ben Whitman on drums, Chris Terry on bass, another live performance here in the Soundcheck studio.
There's a car at the stage door, and the crowds are all gone. In the helter and skelter of love's lost parade, I follow your star. I know it was made for the beautiful light that shines down throughout. You're still the one that I think about. And the streets are like sawdust, and the skies open wide. Facing softly to people outside, I remember your voice.
Once again, that is pianist and singer Lila Bialy here live in the Soundcheck studio with her trio, Ben Whitman on drums and Chris Tarry on bass. Lila is in residence at Subculture New York on Bleecker Street every Monday in July here in New York. And why don't we go right back to another song. You want to do another original for us? Okay.
I'd love to.
This one is called Human Condition. Lila Bialy and the trio live on Soundcheck.
Thank you.
Lila Bialy and her trio live on Soundcheck with an original song called Human Condition, instrumental obviously, and Lila, that's on the live album as well.
It is.
Let me ask you about that album. For the most part, it is clearly, you know, a straight-ahead trio record, but you do a version of Nature Boy, the great old Nat King Cole song.
Yes.
That has a sitar.
My bassist in Toronto, George Kohler, plays a sitar, and I thought, what a great opportunity to take advantage of his multitasking skills.
And then there's a song called Let Go that has what sounds like a chorus at the beginning.
It's the audience.
Really?
Yes. I taught them the intro and created an ad hoc chorus, as it were.
They sounded great.
Weren't they? I know.
That's amazing.
I know. People can sing in tune.
Yeah. All right, so there's more to a Lila Bialy concert than just piano, bass, and drums.
Always surprises.
Well, Lila, it's been great having you and the trio here with us on Soundcheck today.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
breakdown. So let go, get in. Oh, we're so amazing here. It's all right, 'cause there's beauty in the breakdown.
Beautiful.
That's the song Let Go from Lila Bialy's most recent album, simply called Live in Concert. If you liked what you heard live in the Soundcheck studio, you can hear more of it, more music, more conversation from this session on our website, soundcheck.org. Tomorrow on the show, the genre known as smooth jazz faded away on the airwaves a few years ago, but it still has a loyal following. New York Times critic Nate Chenin tells us about his adventure on, brace yourself, a smooth jazz cruise ship. Plus, a live performance from the Brooklyn-based singer-songwriter Senya Rubinos. Remember, you can help us build our playlist for this Friday's show. We want to know about a song or album you missed when it was first released, but which later became a favorite. Leave your pick on a voicemail, 866-939-1612, or post it on soundcheck.org. That's going to do it for the show today. See you back here tomorrow night at 9. I'm John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.